This is Thomas Keegan with LibertarianProgressive.com, and today we're interviewing Lucy Brenton, who's running as a Libertarian candidate for the U.S. Senate in Indiana. She's going to be on the ballot this November 8th, 2016. She's going to be the only third option or third party option independent candidate on the ballot this year for Indiana for Senate. LibertarianProgressive.com is an independent media organization. We interview independent third-party candidates who are on the ballot and the only third-party option on the ballot in their area. There's, we believe, a lot more going on this election season than just the presidential race. We believe Congress, a co-equal branch of government, deserves a co-equal amount of consideration and time in the media. Many, many polls have a consensus to elect all of Congress out. Let's see if that's true. We want to make that decision easier for voters and give them the information with candidates who are the only third-party options in their district. You can find out more information for Lucy's candidacy at Lucy, L-U-C-Y, 4-F-O-R, Senate.com. And Lucy, good to talk with you today, and thank you for being on the show. What got you inspired to run, and is this your first time running for office?
Oh, thank you so much for the compound question. It is not my first time running for office, but I did run for office back in about 1995. Very different climate for me then. I was not quite as busy as I am now, and I ran for city county council. It was a very exciting race because I had so many fellow libertarians that were willing to come and walk my district, and it was small enough that we made quite an impact. As I recall, we got about 12% of the vote back then, which was phenomenal for a third-party candidate. Now, the reason I'm running now, I have 10 children, believe it or not. I have been married for 26 years. My husband and I have 7 daughters, 3 sons. 8 of them still live at home. And in fact, this year we even have a German foreign exchange student. So I have a 9th child, a son, that I didn't have to give birth to that's living with us. So when I look at the way our country's been going, I don't like the way that it's been going. I feel that somebody has to stand up and do something. And whether you have one child or none or 10, there's really no excuse for failing to take action. So I decided if I'm going to leave a legacy, if my grandchildren are going to wake up in a land that's free, then that responsibility falls squarely on my shoulders, and I've got to do something. So this is one of the things that I'm doing.
Excellent. And on your website, you stated that you're an entrepreneur, you know, a family person. You're an author. Also that you have a unique perspective on the fraud committed by Wall Street, and you insist that an honest money system is a foundation of economic stability. I'd like to hear more about that because actually recently we all know about the big bailouts in 2008. However, I heard recently that what if there was another bailout? Some of these banks are, you know, not doing too well in the stress tests. There might be another bubble forming. Could there be another vote on whether the banks get bailed out again? And so would that be a good idea if that's necessary? And so what is your unique perspective on the fraud committed by Wall Street?
Thank you for asking. My unique perspective is because I studied economics in college, and as well as the fact that I've been a mortgage broker since 96. So being in finance and actually writing the mortgages that, you know, may have ended up in the kind of scenarios you see in the movie The Big Short, which, by the way, if you haven't seen the movie The Big Short, it's a really great expose, even though it's fictional. You know, the surrounding events weren't fictional, but obviously the characters are. But this is literally what happened during the big crash in 2008 and 2009. I am not in favor of a bailout for any industry. The banks are no exception, because no business is too big to fail, especially when the failure of that business or the lack of it, the bailout, becomes an additional burden to the taxpayer. One of the biggest problems that we have, obviously, is government interference in any market, and the government interference in the mortgage market was very specific. For those who know a little bit of history, back in the 30s during the Depression, if a bank wanted to go out and buy a block of mortgages, for example, they would need about 30% skin in the game. So to buy $10 million worth of mortgages, they'd need $3 million in cash to accomplish that. Under Clinton's presidency, they revoked that, and they made it 3%. So when you're 30% into a mortgage pool instead of 30% into a mortgage pool, obviously your incentive for safety is not there. And as soon as the foreclosure rate gets to be 3.1 or 4 or 5 or 10%, as people begin to lose their jobs and stop paying on their housing, then you have this snowball, this catastrophe. And that played out in most of our lives back in 2008 and 2009. The next catastrophe that I'm predicting is with regards to finance is going to be with the student loans, because the government entered the marketplace of the student loans by guaranteeing credit of people that were going to go and you know, get a degree. And I won't say I'm a victim, although it would probably be appropriate to say that I'm a victim just like everybody else of the student loan scam. So when the government entered and said, hey, you know, everybody should go to college, which of course isn't true, and they said, okay, so here's what we're going to do. To make sure that everybody can go to college, we're going to have these government-backed loans, which removed the risk from the banks as to whether or not the borrower, the debtor, the college student, would actually pay. So the banks, of course, wanted to loan as much money as they could, and because it was so easy to borrow the money, it gave an incentive for colleges to raise the price. Because then it didn't matter. The price was disconnected. The value of the education was disconnected from what people were willing to pay. Because they no longer had to work in the summer and save enough money to go to school. Now they could loaf off during the summer and just simply sign up for loans. So I see that that's going to be the next biggest disruption in our marketplace. And I certainly hope the government doesn't do anything as stupid as a bailout.
Yes. And what about the fraud? Was there fraud? Did some of the banks commit any criminal activity, do you believe?
Every bank committed criminal activity. Now, I will speak from my own experience, because I experienced two foreclosures, one on a home that I lived in and one on a home that I used to live in, but then became a rental property for me. On the home that I lived in that went into foreclosure because of job loss and everything, I was a mortgage broker when everything went upside down and then there were no mortgages to write. And so, you know, I lost my income, that's why I went into foreclosure. So what happened with my particular loan, the first loan, was the bank did not actually own my loan. It went through mortgage electronics registration systems, which was a very, very crucial part of the fraud for those people who don't know. It's a fascinating discussion we could talk about for hours, so I'm not going to. But because the bank did not actually own my loan, it had gone through MERS, when they filed foreclosure on me, they didn't actually own it. Which is another conundrum that happened to, you know, literally millions of people across this country. So I fought them. I never went to law school. That was always a goal of mine. But when you get married at 19 and you start having babies right away, you know, you don't get to law school. At least I haven't yet. And I fought it myself for 2.5 years. It even got to the point where, well, I and somebody to testify on their behalf on two different occasions, as I stood up Perry Mason style and did oral arguments. And, of course, I'd already done written arguments in the lawsuit. My husband believes that if I had JD after my name, if I successfully made it through law school, because I had them on the law, I was legally correct. But it, in the end, it didn't matter. They still ruled against me and gave my house to the bank. So very sad thing. I've been through that heartache and suffered the stress of having your children live in a house that's in foreclosure. You don't know who's going to knock on the door. I mean, it's a really crazy way to live. Now, the house before that I lost because it was a rental house. We had renters in it. So we moved from one house to the other, turned the old one into a rental. And the renters lost their source of income, so they stopped paying me. And with my loss of income, I couldn't pay two mortgages. So long story short, the particular fraud that was on that loan was what was known as a robo-signer. Have you ever heard of the term robo-signer?
I don't think I have, actually.
Okay, this was a big source of fraud between most of the banks. They started having foreclosure mills, and so they would literally have employees in different states that were signing documents and an employee in a different state that would notarize the document. Now, I am a notary. I used to actually be the treasurer for the Indiana Notary Association, and so I'm very familiar with notary laws. And as a notary, it is my duty to testify and confirm to the identity of the person who's signing the document. This is almost a sacred duty. It's an appointment by the governor of my state, because there has to be, you know, some sort of third party, you know, non-interested party who can say, yes, that's the person who really signed the document. Well, in the case of the robo-signers, when I was doing the legal research, and again, I fought this, I ended up getting a settlement from them because of the fraud that was in the case. And since I didn't live in the property as a rental, I just let it go and took the settlement instead. But the fraud was the guy that signed my foreclosure document was signing 14,000 documents a month. And they were being notarized by someone who wasn't in the same state that he was. So they literally had a team of people that were signing his signature and then boxing them up and sending them off to another state to get them notarized. If you were to go back through my court documents and the court documents of others, we all started to kind of share these documents online, and we found six unique signatures for the same man that signed my foreclosure documents. And that's why they were able to say, okay, we're not chasing you for any of these back payments that you owe. We're just going to give you some money, and we're just all going to drop it. And so I let the bank have the deed back, and then they, of course, resold it. So I'm, on a very, very personal level, familiar with the fraud. And as a mortgage broker who sees those documents on the front end and then knows what happens on the back end, I'm in a unique position to literally know that every bank operates in fraud. There is no exception.
Sure. And when people are deciding who to send to the Senate, you can have someone with this perspective. Or, you know, Hillary Clinton was in the Senate and she was getting these Washington speeches and, you know, $100,000 a speech from Wall Street. So that's the type of status quo versus libertarian candidates. And now on your website, you also have another issue here that I wanted to hear more about. And we'll go through your platform, but it says Lucy is a published author who works tirelessly to expose the hazards of private information falling into the wrong hands. Can you explain that a little bit?
Oh, thank you so much for asking. I think every single person listening, if they've ever had a debit or a credit card, has at some time been the victim of identity theft. And that identity theft accomplished in so many different ways that, you know, certainly we could spend days talking about it. John McAfee, the inventor of the McAfee antivirus, who is also a libertarian candidate for president this last year, talks a lot about protecting your identity. And I do, too. I talk with people about the fact that it doesn't matter how many government regulations there are. They only give you a false sense of security. So with my family, we own and operate a credit repair business called Essential Credit Services, where we help people get their credit fixed so they can be mortgage ready. And we help entrepreneurs get their credit fixed so that they can go get business credit. And then I have business credit sources for them as well. So we help them get that credit. One of the first things that I have to do for most people is to go over their credit reports, and there are other consumer reporting agencies that are covered under the FCRA, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, that most people aren't aware of, like the Medical Information Bureau. You may not realize they compile information about you. They're under the same laws I use in credit repair. All of these places at every level is failing to protect your identity, and they're failing to take proper measures. So I work with a company that offers identity theft services. When people become my clients on the credit repair side, we get them also hooked up with identity theft so that there's somebody that's monitoring their identity 24 hours a day, that's monitoring their social security number. Now, it's sad that we have to go to these respects, but I also want people to think about the fact that the biggest failure to protect their identities comes from the government itself. Just like the government is the biggest polluter, the biggest failures where we've, you know, lost people's information have been things as stupid as, you know, some guy that works at the VA carrying around a laptop that's got, you know, millions of records on it. So people have to understand that the regulations can't and don't protect them, and they must take steps for themselves. Does that make sense?
Sure, absolutely. I know the IRS recently or in the last 2 years had lost something of like 250,000 names and information, you know, database information from people probably having their date of birth, social security number, et cetera. And I'm sure there's more of that going on. Now, have you been in any debates so far? Are there any debates coming up for the Senate in Indiana?
I don't know what your airing date for this will be, but my debate will be October 18th, 2016 at 7 p.m. It should air live on the IndianaDebateCommission.org website. They are a fantastic nonpartisan organization staffed by volunteers of the different parties, and they do a great job working with each other. So for my particular race, traditionally we have two debates. We're only going to have one, though, because my Democratic opponent, Evan Bay, he would just rather not be seen, so he doesn't show up to anything. But he did finally, under great pressure, agree to just the one debate. So if you're listening to this after October 18th of 2016, you can go to YouTube and look at the Indiana Debate Commission's website, and it'll be there, probably archived forever.
Yeah, there's a reason why debates sometimes have altered the entire candidacy or trajectory of it, because that's where people can all at once get the most information, see the candidates interact. And it's been a long time American tradition. Usually, like you said, there's more than one debate. But, you know, you'll take that one debate. What would it be like if Libertarian Lucy Brenton was elected to Congress? What kind of message would that send? What kind of message would that send to the Congress and to the powers that be?
Oh, I think for a Libertarian to be elected to the Senate would rock the halls of Congress, and it would let every old party there, every old party person know that their job is in jeopardy, because people have gotten so disgusted, and this really is a banner year for me and for other Libertarians, because at the top of both of the old party tickets are I cannot think of anybody in the world that is worse than the two of them. And so people are so in disgust that this is what I'm hoping will happen. If people look on their ballots, they're going to go, Evan Bayh, he's that guy that doesn't really live in Indiana. At a press conference, he didn't even know his Indiana address. And he's got two mansions in Washington, D.C. that are like, you know, 10 blocks from each other. So I don't really want to vote for him. And then there's this kind of young guy, and every time he votes, he claims to be conservative, but he always votes with Obama. And, you know, gosh, I just really don't like him. Lucy, I love Lucy. Let's give her a chance. So I'm hoping that even the disgust of people will cause them to vote for me.
Sure, absolutely. The wave of discontent that's on the right and the left. And so even if you're on the left, you know, the message that it would send would be something else. And I can understand people's hesitation regarding the presidential race, where if I take the risk and vote for a third-party candidate, maybe I'm taking a vote away from the one that I don't find as evil of the lesser two evils. However, when it comes to Congress, the Senate, the House of Representatives, there really isn't that same risk, because you're in a House or a body of 100 people and as a senator. So if there's any place to really vote your heart or, you know, your mind, your conscience, I think the Senate or the House of Representatives, Congress, in other words, would be the place to make it so. And
I think that is an excellent observation, because, you know, you're looking at the three judicial branches, right? Executive, legislative, and the representative. So you've got the presidency, and then you've got the Supreme Court, and then you've got the senators. So even one Libertarian voice in there, one that, like myself, takes no corporate money, is not bought by corporations. You know, I have 10 children, and I'm poor now. I don't want to go to Congress to make millions of dollars. I want to go so that when my grandchildren wake up, my great-grandchildren wake up, and I'm not here, that the world will be a better place and a more free place for them in this country, because I serve.
All right. And now on your issues list, and people can see all the issues, we might not get through all of them, but again, we're talking with, you can visit your website, LucyForSenate.com, LucyForSenate.com. And we're talking with Lucy Brenton, who's a Libertarian candidate, the only third party option for Senate in Indiana this year, 2016, and you can visit her website, see the issues, the bio, etc. You have here agriculture hemp, and
yeah,
if you could explain that a little bit.
Oh, thanks so much. Well, my full stance on marijuana and hemp is that we should re-legalize marijuana now and hemp. And I say re-legalize because it was legal in 1932 and before. Throughout our country's history, people have had access to this very important plant and its medicine. But because industries like the cotton industry, the oil industry, they were very, very afraid of hemp, because hemp can be grown, and this is why it's such a shame it's not been grown right now in Indiana. We have some of the best soil in the Midwest. Hemp is a crop that doesn't need a pesticide, so we can get rid of all those toxins that are ending up in our groundwater that are being sprayed on soybeans and corn. But if we were to grow two or three cycles of hemp in a year and then take that and make it into oil, that oil can be used to power cars. That oil can be converted, just like petroleum can, into plastics. Henry Ford even had a car that was made of like a hemp fiberglass material and ran on hemp oil. So it's very clear that even back in the early 1900s, people knew the potential for hemp. They knew that it was important as a textile and, of course, as a paper, but it threatened those very industries. And so, you know, for those people who are, you know, into studying it and that sort of thing, the history is absolutely fascinating on how this very useful plant was taken away from us. Don't know about your state, wherever you are,
Florida, my esteemed
listener. Okay, so you're in Florida. So you guys are doing a good battle right now with medical marijuana. Indiana's a little bit behind you. But when I look at the stranglehold that the pharmaceutical industry has on medications for depression, for relief for patients of chemotherapy and cancer, for cures for cancer itself, or even for pain, in my state, we have a huge heroin problem. We have an opioid addiction problem. Many people are using that because they're either depressed and they're looking to change their brain chemistry so they don't feel depressed. Well, it's kind of difficult not to be depressed given our current political climate, isn't it? But then for those people that are in pain, many report that marijuana would actually ease their pain better. They've tried it, but they can't get it because it's illegal or they're scared of the criminal penalties. And, of course, all that does is keep the pharmaceutical companies very, very profitable while the health of Americans decline. So my complete stance is the re-legalization immediately of marijuana and hemp for medicinal, recreational, and industrial uses across the board.
Yeah, more competition in Congress, more competition in the marketplace. You just follow the money. If you look at Colorado, who did legalize cannabis, the biggest special interests that were against that movement by putting the most money into anti-advertising for it, although it still lost, was the alcohol industry and the pharmaceutical industry. So I think the U.S. military had an old video back in World War II called Hemp for Victory.
I used to own a copy of that.
Now you have here the environment as well. How should we approach the environment?
Well, that's a really good question because as a libertarian, I am so often accused of being an anarchist, which for me is personally true. I consider myself an anarcho-capitalist. But they mean anarchy in a way that, oh, it's a free-for-all and everybody gets to do whatever they want to do. And that's simply not true. In fact, the libertarian way of dealing with the environment, I think, is clearly superior. I'm going to give it to you in a nutshell and then give you an example from my personal life. So polluter that we have right now is the United States government. And the second biggest polluter are corporations. And the reason these corporations are not held accountable is because they pay off politicians with, for example, campaign contributions or junkets around the world. And those politicians then write loopholes and exemptions that you can drive a semi-truck through so that those corporations can freely poison the environment with no one to stop them. Now, in my own life, when I was only 20 years old, I worked at the wastewater treatment plant in Indiana. That's a different story that's really funny, but the thing that I took away from that was listening to the fellow that was in charge of making sure the water went out clean to Indiana residents. And he said one of his biggest challenges was corporate polluters. An example at the time was Riley Chemical, who would routinely dump chemicals from their manufacturing into the city sewers. Well, when that water recycled back to the wastewater treatment plant, it would cost us $300,000 to clean up the mess. But the fine that he was able to levy against them was only $25,000. So clearly, it was more profitable for them to poison rather than to be a good corporate citizen. So I want a day when they realize that it's better to do good business and it's more profitable to do good business than to poison our land, water, and air. And the way to do that in a libertarian fashion is through the laws of trespass. My rights stop where your nose begins. And where my property lines are, you're not allowed to come across, whether you're coming across personally, you know, to hurt me, or whether you're causing a harm like a chemical. You know, if my neighbor were spraying Roundup on his yard, I wouldn't want it on mine. So if he got that Roundup onto my yard, that's a trespass, and I would have the right to make him stop. And if he harmed me, for example, if he was spraying the Roundup near my organic tomatoes and I lost my crop, then he should have to pay me for the loss. So in the corporate sense, these corporate polluters should be held to strict trespass laws. They should be made to absolutely clean up the damage that they've done, and then I believe a fine should be levied on top of them that is so large that they would never consider polluting again. Does that make sense?
So you're stronger on the environment than some people might think from a libertarian. Yeah, it does make sense. I mean, if people were held accountable for all the pollution, you know, there'd be a lot of not as much of it at all. Now, some of these other issues we might not have time for, but abortion, like basically you'd like to see less of it, but the federal government shouldn't really play a role. Gay rights, believe equality for everyone under the law. What about, let's see here, there's a foreign policy. Now, this is a big issue nowadays, and it has been ever since 9/11. And so if you could talk about how you would approach the foreign policy.
Thank you for asking. And that is something that I'm going to be involved in as a senator, so it's important you had asked me that question. With regards to foreign policy, the first thing that we have to look at is A, unintended consequences, and B, our constitutional directive. I think you and I both know that Congress is supposed to declare war, and that hasn't happened. Now, we've had some stupid things like, you know, the war on poverty, which we spent trillions of dollars at, and people are even more poor. And, of course, the taxpayers are more poor, and the men are more poverty-stricken. But when you look at the foreign wars, and, you know, they're talking about Aleppo and Syria, and what are we doing there in Afghanistan? If people will take a really bird's-eye look at this and be honest about why are we in Syria, it's because we have two competing pipelines, and our U.S. military, our sons and daughters, brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers, they are being used as mercenaries to enforce a government policy that benefits corporations by making sure that the natural resources of those countries flow back to corporations. So for those of your listeners who are readers and researchers, I recommend you get the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. It'll show you how the money flows out of the International Monetary Fund as a loan to, say, Bolivia for a hydroelectric dam. And then that hydroelectric dam is built, but only if the contract gives all the construction engineering work to U.S. firms. So you've got, you know, $1 billion gets loaned out for this dam because the people are told that it's going to give them a 17% higher GDP. But after it's built, you know what? They only get a 2% increase in their GDP, but the loan is for 4%. So now they're upside down. They can't pay the loan. Well, you know, if you're a mortgage company, you can foreclose on somebody, and that's what happened to me, and they took my property. But if you're a country, how do you foreclose on a country? Well, you take their natural resources, and you might try using your ambassador to nicely convince them first. And if that doesn't work, you might send in the CIA to kill them. And if that doesn't work, well, then you send in the Marines. And this is what's happening all over the world as the U.S. empire, this colonialist, expansionist government that's really not very distinguished from, you know, distinguishably different from, you know, the Great Britain that we left in the 1700s. We're going around the world, and we're taking countries' natural resources. So while I'm here, I'm going to make a prediction that Afghanistan, I've just heard that Afghanistan has a vein of lithium in its mountains that's worth $1 trillion. My iPhone has a lithium battery. I'm going to guess that for the rest of my life, we're probably going to be in some sort of war in Afghanistan. And so my foreign policy would be first to follow the Constitution. If Congress isn't declaring war, why are we over there? I want our men and women brought back here to the United States where they can defend us. Now, the most ideal situation is also to follow what the Constitution says, which is that we don't have a standing army, but we do have a Navy. And that if we follow that Constitution strictly, I think we'll discover we shouldn't have 900 bases around the world and we shouldn't, you know, be assassinating elected leaders. Does it make sense? I don't think we should be in the business of regime change. We should just keep our noses out of it.
Sure. And like you said, we'll probably be there unless if we elect you or more people like you in Congress. And that also goes into the environment. I'm sure there's a lot of unintended consequences to the environment and also the free market regarding picking winners and losers. So a very huge, huge issue. And let me ask you in closing here, Ms. Brenton, who are some of your favorite people, past or present?
Oh, gosh. But, you know, that's such a funny question because people always ask me who my favorite president is, and I always say Grover Cleveland because I can't think of anything that he did. And so if I can't point to, you know, like the New Deal with FDR, you know, or Obamacare with Obama, then I figure he must have been a pretty decent president. If I could go back and have more time with anybody, I lost my mom 6 years ago, almost, I guess 7 years ago now. I'd love to have some time with her. Those are my two favorite people in history, though.
All right. Well, we appreciate your time today. And are there any final words of wisdom that you'd like to share?
Yes, please. I'd like everybody to get up off their butts and take personal responsibility for their own freedom. First, watch the YouTube video, The Story of Your Enslavement. It's the best 13 minutes you'll spend today. Then I'd like you to go to lucyforsenate.com, make a donation so that I can get more advertising out there in this particular race. That'll give us a stronger cause for liberty. And sign up for my newsletter, because this is not going to end with this particular Senate race. Sadly, I'm a realist, and I don't expect to win. I do expect to advance the cause of liberty, and I hope to have myself in a better position to run for another office that I can win in the future. So please help me.
Well, good luck in your campaign. Good luck in the debates. You never know. That's why we do have the elections, and we don't want to call them at any time before the election dates. So it's been a pleasure, and I hope you have a great day. And thank you for taking the time to do this interview and enlighten our audience. We appreciate it very much. Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks so much. It was such a pleasure. Have a good day.